I have a subject. It's human evolution and space anthropology. Actually, there's a distinction without a difference in entirety, but it is of value to look at them as two separate realities now and then for the purposes of clarity, because the wide world, you might say, knows nothing of this identity. You think in here. Since this is a theosophical audience, and we have a theosophical subject and a theosophical speaker, we don't need to give any time to Mr. Darwin, since our subject starts with human evolution. The Darwinists are having a bad time as it is. There are plenty of thoughtful people who regard natural selection as a bit of a fraud, that it tells us how species survive, but nothing about how they originated, and that was the title of his book, Origin of Species. So we'll pass that, and we'll turn to the, we should add, that according to theosophy, there are three lines of evolution, and the physical or biological line is only one. The other two are intellectual and spiritual. We won't take the time to endeavor to define spiritual evolution, except to say that it's an increase in the radius of the self. Intellectual evolution is what we're primarily concerned with here, the reason that we're in the fourth round in the theosophical scheme. The monads came over from the moon, and they've been circling our planetary global system of seven globes for three times, and now the fourth. And we're in a little beyond the middle of the fourth round. The statement of the secret doctrine, we're going to use this text because this is my idea of networking. Skip into the original books. And if we all do it, the problems of unity will be enormous. Round four. This is SD1, original edition, 189. I won't get the numbers after this. It's silly. Round four. Intellect has an enormous development in this round. That characterizes our age. Now, what can we say about our evolution? Well, we have to lock in the background. The fourth round is the fourth principle. The fourth principle is desire. Desire is the common theme of the fourth round. And we are the fifth race, and the fifth sub-race of the fifth race, giving us two emphases on mind under the surveillance, so to speak, or animation of desire. That is characteristic. And now, I'm very glad that what was said about Mr. Judge, because I want to read from him, and we'll see at once what he says, in effect, about the middle of the fifth race in the fourth round. He says in The Ocean of Theosophy, page 50, "Hence it is taught that today man shows himself to be moved by passion and desire. This is proved by a glance at the civilizations of the earth. For they are all moved by this principle, and in countries like France, England, and America, a glorification of it is exhibited in the attention to display, to sensuous art, to struggle for power and place, and in all the habits and modes of living, where the gratification is sometimes esteemed the highest good." All you have to do is look at the newsstand. He's right. It's still that way, and it works. At the same time, we can endorse what immediately follows. But as mind is being involved more and more, as we proceed our course along the line of the race development, there can be perceived underneath in all countries the beginning of a transition from the animal possessed of the germ of real mind to the man of mind complete. It seems to be appropriate to say that this is the fundamental motive for the theosophical movement, that the adepts and their emissary, the teacher, representative, Madame Blavatsky, saw this. They have the vistas which can stand over the rise and fall of nations. And they must know it. They are pedagogues in the best sense. They must know about the rhythms of the juxtaposition of our principles and the emergence of a greater power of mind. This very country is an illustration of this. The Declaration of Independence is a great book. It is a treatise on the nature of man. No other country in the world that we know of founds itself on philosophical principles concerning the nature of man. They don't celebrate a rock or a mountain or a river. They celebrate the nature of man. That is a business in which, under the inspiration of Adept took a part, Thomas Paine, who is really, as much as Washington, in many ways, the father of our country. All right. Now let's get back to the fundamental theme of evolution. What is it, theosophically? I have a couple of passages. Every form on earth, every speck or atom in space strives in its efforts for self-formation to follow the model placed for it in the heavenly man. It, the atom's involution and evolution, its external and internal growth and development, have all one and the same object. Man. Man is the highest physical and ultimate form on this earth. The monad in its absolute totality, an awakened condition as the culmination of the divine incarnations on earth. One more. Man is certainly no special creation. As he is the product of nature's gradually effective work, like any other living unit on this earth. But this is only with regard to the human tabernacle. That was about form. That was about the occupation of the first 3.5 rounds. Remembering former evolution on the moon, recapitulating, bringing the development of form to that climactic moment when the incarnation of mind could take place. That which lives and thinks in man and survives that frame, the masterpiece of evolution, the eternal pilgrim, the protean differentiation in space and time of the one absolute unknown. That is what she says we are. It is the divinity in man that becomes most evident in the works of Madame Blavatsky. And let's read just a little from Mr. Judge. What he thinks of about evolution. And we already identified evolution, lowercase, with man's development, namely the theosophical movement. What then is the universe for? And for what final purpose is man, the immortal thinker, here in evolution? It is all for the experience and the emancipation of the soul. For the purpose of raising the entire mass of manifested matter up to the stature, nature, and dignity of conscious godhood. The great aim is to reach self-consciousness, not through a race or a tribe or some favored nation, but by and through the perfecting after transformation of the whole mass of matter, as well as what we now call soul. This is the meaning of our pilgrimage. This is the mission that we are called to. This is the definition in theosophical language of man as a Promethean hierarchy. What was the character of Prometheus? He looked out on mankind and he saw they were bemused like tribes of sheep who were numbed and couldn't think and he couldn't stand it. And he went up to Valhalla, Olympus, and stole the fire and brought it down in a reed. It wasn't only a technological fire, it was that. It was also a fire of mind. Prometheus is the symbol of the hierarchy of the Manasaputra, the Agishwarapitris. That's what he stands for. And we have it ourselves from the Greeks, with the illuminating background of the secret doctrine. Let's remember that it's fortunate that the first speaker this morning gave close attention to the Neoplatonists. At the beginning of the key, as most of you know, she adopts the Neoplatonists as the expression of the Theosophical movement of 1,500 years ago. And let us note that the murder of Hypatia, which took place in 414 AD, is exactly 1,500 years from the outbreak of World War I. Very interesting coincidence of dates with the average cycle of reincarnations. Now, let us talk about what H.P. says about evolution specifically. This is in Volume 1 in the section Primordial Matter and Divine Thought. The evolution of the God idea proceeds apace with man's own intellectual evolution. So true is it that the noblest ideal to which the religious spirit of one age can soar will appear but a gross caricature to the philosophic mind in a succeeding epoch. The philosophers themselves had to be initiated into perceptive mysteries before they could grasp the correct idea of the ancients in relation to this most metaphysical subject. The evolution of the God idea is identical with the awareness of the self. We are that. The problem is all those barriers and containers and fires and vehicles that are obscure and have to be cleaned, like the surfaces of the Leibnizian mind made to reflect clear. Otherwise, outside such initiation, for every thinker there will be a thus far thou shalt go, no farther, mapped out by his intellectual capacity as clearly and as unmistakably as there is for the progress of any nation or race if cycled by the law of karma. Now, let us ask, what are these obstacles? What are the barriers? And notice she took an exception. Those who are initiated into perceptive mysteries are not subject to these limitations. And when you think about it, you look at the evolution of the Western mind, the gradual century by century awakening in progress as a result of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, the European thought, the discoveries of Galileo, of Kepler, of Newton, all of these things are part of the awakening of the Western mind, the translation by the Jews in the Pyrenees of the original Platonic, or rather the Arabic versions of the Platonic, into Latin, sparking the 12th century Renaissance, awakening people like Peter Abelard, and instructing the medieval philosophers who were still representatives in some sense of the philosophical movement. What were the barriers? Well, if you look at the characteristics of our mind, on the emotional side and the appetitive side, we have a desire nature which dominates our culture. There's another aspect. The wonderful thing about our culture is its capacity for analysis and abstract thinking. This is lower manus at its best, at its unimpeded function. Mathematics is a symbol of this power. Let's go back to the Greeks. You start with the 6th century B.C. with Thales and Anaximander and Eximenes, Heraclitus. What did they do? They looked the principles of matter, the evident ones, as suppose air, water, fire, and earth. And they said, it's all this, or it's all that. And Western historians thought that they meant it in those literal terms. Whereas H.P.B. points out, they were mostly initiates. And they meant the invisible archetypal principles, not the water we drink, the fire we gives us heat, or the air we breathe, but they were primordial matter, mula prakriti, akasha. Now these were the principles they were really talking about, but the Western thinkers didn't know that. So they said these were the beginning of the science. They were. After them came the Atomists, the Kippists, Democritus, Lucretius in Rome, with his poem, The Nature of Things to which we owe the phrase, a fortuitous concourse of atoms. If you go from time of Lucretius to the 19th century, you find that in the 19th century, John Tyndall went back and studied all the Greek atomists and pointed out Well, they knew as much as we did. Now, they were not experimentalists. They didn't know it in the same test tube way that the 19th century scientists did. But the theory was all there. An interesting point. I have a lovely quotation from Tyndall, but I better skip it. I can't find it. Now, what can we say about this whole scientific movement up until that point in the 19th century, when there they were with those billion ball atoms and the random bouncing around of those atoms producing, a Beethoven and an Einstein. It's ridiculous. But they believed it. If you go back and read the published, the beginning of the 19th century, works of the emergent evolutionists, or better yet, take some book critical of them, which summarizes the five and six, they all didn't know how to get this out of the hat of blind matter. They knew what happened, there it was, the geniuses are cultured. And they struggled with this problem. That's the content of the books about emergent evolution.
It'd be a mouse somewhere.
Now, we talked about the reason for those limits and the character of our thinking. It's analytical, it's objective. And we reached the latter part of the 19th century with those Billy Ball atoms. Her point is this, that we have to transcend those limits by penetrating. It says, whatever plane our consciousness may be acting in, both we and the things belonging to that plane are, for the time being, our only realities. This means there has to be a tangible release from those illusions. And she puts it this way, the ego progressing in an arc of ascending subjectivity must exhaust experience of every plane. In other words, you've got to wear out the illusion in order to transcend it. So, the concept of the physical world being the only reality, which is characteristic of the scientific point of view, and which was enthroned in the atomic conception, this is what had to be worn out, exhausted. So here's that thing it was in a book by Millikan, Robert A. Millikan, Electrons Pop, Plus and Minus. This is what he says, making a summary. Those principles, with a few modifications and omissions, might almost pass muster today. The great advance which has been made in modern times is not so much in the conceptions themselves as in the kind of foundation upon which the conceptions rest. And the reason why I chose this kind of development to discuss, because there's a puzzling thing about what we may speak of as the assistance given by the adepts to the world mind. We know what they do for the theosophical movement proper, the climax of which is initiation from the Neoplatonists on, the revival of learning in Florence under Pico della Mirandola and Marsilio Ficino, no doubt under Elizabethan England, because you don't get a flowering of genius like that without the presence of adepts. Or the adepts of 1776 that Judge speaks of and writes about, and the inspiration of that extraordinary galaxy of thinkers called the Founding Fathers. Now, as to the Western time and its awakening, occult philosophy divulges few of its most important and vital mysteries. It drops them like precious pearls, one by one, far and wide, and only when forced to do so by the evolutionary tidal wave that carries on humanity slowly, silently, but steadily, toward the dawn of the sixth race, mankind. Those who are heirs to primeval revelations have taught these possibilities in every century, but have never found a fair hearing. The truths inspired to Kepler, Leibniz, Gassendi, Swedenborg, etc., were alloyed with their own speculations in one or another predetermined direction, hence distorted. What she's saying is, what do you want? One more minute. I was going to jump to transportation, which is essential to the thing that I'm going to point out. One by one, facts and processes in nature's workshops are permitted to find their way into the exact sciences, while mysterious help is given to rare individuals in unraveling its arcana. It is at the cause of great cycles, in connection with racial development, that such events generally take place. We are at the very close of the cycle of 5,000 years of the present Kali Yuga. And between this time and 1897, there will be a large red man in the veil of nature, and materialistic science will receive a death blow. What happened? Well, for those in the audience, I know they know what happened. But what happened was the discovery of radiation in 1896 by Becquerel, resulting a few years later in Dr. Einstein's formulas, and later we pointed out in the evolution of physics that that matter is where energy is concentrated. This is the dissolution of the atom. This is the reduction of matter to energy. This is a death blow to technical materialism, not moral materialism. There's one more thing that I want to call attention to, and that is a prophecy by Mr. Judge in the Path magazine after the first year. It's called A Year on the Path, an editorial. In the middle of it, unattended by other comment, he said, "The Christian nations have dazzled themselves with the baneful glitter of material promise. They are not the peoples who furnish the clearest views, clues to the path. A few short years and they will have abandoned the systems now held so dear, because their mad rush to the perfection of their civilization will give them control over now undreamed of forces. Then will come the moment when they must choose which of two kinds of fruit they will take. In the meantime, it is well to try to show a relation between their present system and the old, or at least to pick out what grains of truth there are in them." Well, is there any? Could it be clearer? Could it be clearer? Undreamed of power. He wrote that in 1897. So, I think it's fair to say that we have exhausted the plane of material reality in terms of our scientific progress, since the scientific thinkers have a great deal to think to do with the thinking of the rest of the world, shaping what you might say the background matrix, and it filters down, not like Adam Smith's theory, and becomes the frame of reference. It's gone. And what I had intended to do with three or four more quotations is to show, by quotation from four or five distinguished thinkers and scientists, that the level of their interest is no longer the nature of the physical world. Werner Heisenberg says, we've got to stop looking for those fundamental blocks. We ought to give attention to Platonic symmetries. This is a physicist. Or Jonas Salk, discoverer of the polio vaccine. He says we're getting a further incarnation of mind. He doesn't use those words, but it's identical with his meaning. And he talks about the obstacles to the awakening of mind. He says, what's wrong? What's in the way? And he has a whole long paragraph, about 80 words, on selfishness, but he never uses the word. He characterizes the various forms of self-interest in other language. In other words, it's behavioral without using the moral language. But the point is the same. If these people aren't talking about brotherhood, why are they talking about it? That is a kind of networking, I think, that now we can begin to add. We can read Simone Weil and read what she says on responsibility. Read Hannah Arendt, what she says. What is responsibility? It's the Promethean spirit. Arendt says, no one who isn't ready to take responsibility for the world, and that's what Prometheus did, should be permitted to have contact with children. Because they have the job of introducing the world to the children. And we have to say it's our world. We may not like it, we may want to change it. And then there's a computer expert, teaches computer science at MIT, Langbaum, who says at the end of his book, Computers and Human Intelligence, the general idea of how to improve the world is to get other people to believe sound ideas. He said that's absolutely false. The only thing that is right and true and necessary is that each one regard the world as his responsibility, as though the salvation of the world depended upon him, and so may, without troubling one's mind too much about what other people think. Again, this is the Promethean idea. This is the Luciferian idea. This is the Arjuna idea. It's coming out in our culture in threads and veins and fluttering ideas. And it's going to take...
Can I say something about enthusiasm?